final burst, then spun him around. The outer airlock door of the Rosinante was already open, waiting for them. Naomi drifted inside, grabbed a handhold, and waited for them to follow. Shaded from Illis's star, the polarization of her faceplate faded, and the blue glow of the airlock's LED lights illuminated the inside of her helmet. Her wide smile was clearly visible. "Home again, home again," she said. Baja drifted in next to her, and she caught his arm to stop him. "Thank you for coming for me." Baja blushed and raised his palms in a belter shrug. "I didn't do much but get shot at. Sometimes just showing up is a lot." Havelock caught the edge of the airlock entrance and stopped, looking back toward the Israel. "Hey, you got Drake? He okay?"
"Yes, sir,"
Kemp replied. "We caught him." "Havelock," the older, angrier voice said. "You won't get away with this. RCE will burn you to the ground when we get back, and I'll be there to see it happen." Havelock laughed. "Chief, I hope we both live so long. Havelock out." He backed into the airlock and slapped the wall panel to start the cycle. "We made it," Baja said. He felt a brief moment of euphoria, followed by a sudden release of pants-shitting terror he hadn't even known he'd been repressing. If he'd been standing in gravity, he would have collapsed. Naomi and Havelock began stripping off their EVA packs while the airlock ran through the pressurization cycle. Baja fumbled at the straps of his own, but his hands were shaking so badly he couldn't manage it. After a few moments, Naomi helped him pull it off. The pack drifted across the compartment and hit the bulkhead with a dull thud. Baja had just enough time to realize he'd actually heard something other than his own breathing when the inner airlock door slid open. Alex floated, framed by the airlock entrance, a goofy grin on his broad, dark face.
"XO," he said. "Good to have you back on the ship."
Naomi pulled her helmet off and tossed it to him.
"Good to be back, Mr. Kamal."
There was a short pause while they grinned at each other. Then Naomi pushed off toward him and Alex grabbed her in a hug.
"They treat you okay?"
Alex said.
"Kept me locked in a kennel like a dog," Naomi replied, jerking her head toward Havelock. The squat Earthman had removed his own helmet, and it floated in the air next to him. He was wearing a sheepish half-smile. Without his helmet on, Baja saw his short, light-colored hair, a square jaw, and dark eyes. A sort of generic, rugged handsomeness. Like a video star playing a cop in an action movie. It made Baja want to dislike him.
"It was policy," Havelock said. I was chief of ship security on the Edward Israel. I think I may have just resigned that position. I was the one that took your XO captive. I hope you won't hold that against me."
"Okay," Alex said, then turned back to Naomi as if Havelock weren't even there.
"What now?"
"Status report," Naomi replied. "What's the latest on the degrading orbit?"
"Barba Pecola's going down first, then the Israel, then we get to pick between dying in orbit when the batteries run out, burning in the atmosphere, or getting shot by aliens,"
Alex said with a humorless laugh.
"We're all fucked 6 ways from Sunday, but it's nice to have you back on board."
Chapter 44. Holden. Holden shuffled his way around the tower again. He tried to calculate how many hours he'd gone without sleep, but his brain had lost the ability to do math, and Illis's 30-hour day kept screwing up his estimates. A long time was all he could come up with. He triggered his armor's medical system to shoot him up with more amphetamines, and was troubled when the HUD told him the supply was empty. How much did that mean he'd taken? Like the question of how long it had been since he slept, it was an insoluble mystery. A pair of death slugs were climbing the side of the tower toward a teardrop-shaped window.
The plastic that had been stretched across the opening had a few small rips in it, so Holden knocked the slugs off the wall with his shovel and then kicked them away. He rinsed the toxic slime off his boot in a muddy puddle. The rain had lessened to a drizzle, which was good, but the temperature had continued to drop, which was bad. While the overall light level didn't change much with the constant cloud cover, Holden had started noticing the day-to-night transition by the appearance of frost on the walls of the tower. It wasn't dangerously cold yet, but it would get worse. Pretty soon the survivors would be adding hypothermia to their list of unpleasant ways to die. He bit his tongue until it bled and continued his slow trudge around the tower. He heard Murtry before he saw him. A quiet, ghostly voice drifting out of the gray rain that gradually resolved into a man-shaped spot slightly darker than the space around it.
Immediate action. They've escalated. We'll have an argument that we acted with restraint until...
Murtry was saying, but stopped when he heard Holden approaching.
What are you doing out here?
Holden asked. Murtry was still blind. It was dangerous for him to be wandering around outside. The ground, where it wasn't puddles, was a slick clay that could take someone off their feet in a heartbeat. And the numbers of slugs driven to the surface by the water had Holden wondering if Illis was a hollow ball filled with poisonous worms.
"Minding my business, Captain," Murtry said,
not quite looking in Holden's direction.
"Meaning I should do the same?" "Glad you followed that."
The two men stood for a long moment. Far above them, their crews were probably shooting at each other right now. They were enemies, and they weren't. Some part of Holden's sleep-deprived, half-broken mind still wanted to make peace with Murtry and the RCE, or at least didn't want the man's death on his conscience.
"It's dangerous out here," Holden said, keeping his own voice even and calm. "That makes it different? How?"
Again, the clenched jaw cutting off the last word with a snap. His anger gave Holden a thin sliver of hope. Maybe Naomi had gotten out. He needed to talk to Alex.
"I can't let you get killed on my watch," Holden said. "I appreciate your concern."
It all felt vaguely ridiculous, tap dancing around the issue. They both knew what was happening. He felt like they were playing poker and only pretending they couldn't see each other's hand.
"Can I help you back inside?" Holden asked. "I have some business to finish up here," Murtry replied with a meaningless smile. "When we find your corpse later, I'm going to tell everyone I warned you." "If I die," Murtry said, his smile becoming a shade more genuine, "I'll try to leave a note saying it wasn't your fault."
He signaled the end of the conversation by turning away and mumbling into his hand terminal. Holden left him and immediately called Alex.
"Kind of busy here, Cap,"
the pilot said without preamble.
"Tell me we're busy because you've rescued Naomi and everything is going perfectly. Is she on the ship?"
There was a long pause as Alex noisily exhaled into the microphone.
"So, that part where I went to rescue Naomi? Yeah. I sent Baja."
Holden spun on his heel to look back at Murtry. The RCE security chief was still talking on his hand terminal.
"We sent the prisoner to rescue another prisoner? If that hasn't already worked, I think I may be watching Murtry order their executions right now." "No, no," Alex said in a rush. "It did kind of go to shit, but the radio chatter I'm getting makes me think Naomi's fine. In fact, I think she might be escaping on her own and saving Baja."
Holden couldn't help but laugh. Murtry's head swiveled, looking for the source of the laughter with blind eyes.
"Sounds about right. Where are they now?" "It's a little confusing, actually," Alex said. "I've definitely got Baja's IFF pinging away outside the Israel, but there are a bunch of other suits out there, so it's complicated."
"Can you, you know, ask?"
"Yeah, no. Baja switched channels on me without leaving the old channel open. Not a guy who's done a lot of tactical comm drills, I'm guessing. I'm hoping one of them starts talking to me so I can get the new frequencies.
Holden watched Murtry, probably using his radio to coordinate the pursuit of Naomi and whoever else she was with now. He fought down a sudden urge to walk over to the man, knock him to the ground, take his terminal, and demand to know what the hell was going on. And then he stopped fighting. Murtry had just started to turn toward him, frowning at the sound of his approaching steps, when Holden yanked the terminal out of his hand and shoved him to the muddy ground.
"Stay down there or I'll beat you unconscious," he told the RCE man.
Holding the terminal to his ear, he said, "Who's on the other end of this?"
"Who the fuck is this? Where's Murtry?"
"I'm standing on him right now," Holden said, "so if you're part of the team that's chasing Naomi Nagata, you should stop." The man on the other end said, "Comms is compromised, switch to 2-Alpha," and the connection dropped. Someone who'd spent some time training on tactical comms, it seemed.
"Alex," Holden said, "I've disrupted their command channel. Go get our people."
"Not a problem, boss. The situation is clarified some. I've got 3 coming aboard."
"Who's the 3rd?
"About to go find out. Alex out."
Murtry pushed himself to his knees with a grunt, frowning at a spot just over Holden's left shoulder.
"Tough guy when your opponent is blind."
"We're working on fixing that," Holden replied, tossing the man's hand terminal to the ground next to him.
"You feel free to come look me up after."
"I will," Murtry said.
The RCE security chief picked himself up and began carefully walking toward the alien tower's entrance. When he was far enough away he wouldn't hear, Holden said, "Looking forward to it." He was surprised to find that was true. When Murtry disappeared around the corner of the tower, Holden began his slow trudge the other direction. His earbud crackled to life, and Amos said,
"Cap, that doctor's looking for you."
"Lucia or Elvie?"
"The cute one."
"Lucia or Elvie?"
"The one not married to our prisoner."
"Tell LV I'll be there after this pass around the tower," Holden said and killed the connection.
A few minutes later, he rounded the last corner, bringing the tower entrance into sight. LV was waiting for him there, her face set in a deep frown.
"It didn't work," Holden said.
"What?"
"The oncocytals. My medicine, it's not working."
"What?" LV replied.
"Why'd you say that? What happened?"
"You're frowning."
"Oh, no, I was just thinking that the membrane-bound proteins in our cells must have some sort of functional sites in common with the local life. Even though, as far as I can tell, they're totally different proteins. The oncocytals are having a similar effect on mitotic division, even though our amino acid groups barely overlap. It'll take decades to figure that one out."
"So, let's pretend I have no idea what you're talking about," Holden said.
"It's working," Elvie said, and her frown shifted into a brilliant smile. "The microorganism cell replication is failing. The colonies are breaking down, and the light scattering effect is going too. I can almost read again, if the font's big enough."
Holden felt a rush of relief that immediately turned into a wave of dizziness. He collapsed against the wall of the tower, taking long, slow breaths to keep from passing out. A few meters away, a slug crawled along the wall toward him. He started to poke it off the wall with his shovel, then realized he'd lost it somewhere and he couldn't feel his hands.
"Are you okay?"
Elvie asked, reaching out tentatively with one hand to find him.
"Your respiration sounds funny."
"Passing out," Holden said between long breaths. "How long until everyone can see again?"
"We need to get you inside," Elvie replied, throwing his left arm around her shoulders and guiding him to the door. "I think you've been awake for something like 4 days."
"It's okay," Holden said. "I took a lot of speed. How long?" Elvie stopped, throwing her other arm around his waist to hold him up. It was both a relief and, if he were being honest, a little unflattering, how quickly every bit of sexual tension had been drained from their interactions. He was giddy and sleep-deprived enough he almost asked her what had changed. Fortunately, she spoke first.
"Not sure,"
The dead organism isn't refracting light like the live ones do. Most of the loss of vision came from that, not from actual blockages. We'll still have some floaties in our eyes for a while, but...
So, that means soon?
Elvi got him to the doorway and over to a pile of blankets. She gently lowered him until he was lying flat on his back.
Yes, soon, I should think. Hours, maybe. Days at the most.
How did you know these blankets were here?
We laid this out as a sleeping location for you 3 days ago, Elvi said with a smile and patted his cheek. You were just too stubborn to use it.
Thank you.
We have a small privacy tent, too, she replied, pulling on something by his feet. A thin sleeve of material sprang up and along the length of his body, completely covering him.
Thank you, Holden said again,
his eyes closing against his will. He could already feel the impending sleep as a tingling in his extremities.
Wake me up in about a year. Oh, and make sure Murtry doesn't kill me until then.
Why would he do that? Elvi asked.
We're kind of at war, Holden said. Unconsciousness washed into him, sleep pulling him down into the endless void.
So, a voice said right next to his ear.
We really need to get a move on.
Miller, Holden said, not opening his eyes. If you make me get up, I swear I will find a way to murder you.
You did your bit here, Miller continued, undeterred. Now you need to come with me and do the other thing. And I'm not sure how much time we've got. So upsy-daisy.
Holden forced his eyes open and looked to his side. Miller was inside the tent with him, but also too large to be in the tent with him. The overlapping images sent a spike of pain through his head, so he closed them again.
Where are we going?
Got a train to catch. Find the back room with a weird pillar in the middle. You guys are using the space for storage. I'll meet you there.
I hate you so, so much, Holden said.
But there was no reply. He risked opening one eye and saw Miller was gone. When he opened the tent, Elvi was sitting next to it looking worried.
Who were you talking to?
Ghost of Christmas Past, Holden said, forcing himself to sit up. Where's Amos?
He's been spending a lot of time with Wei. I think they're both in the next room.
Help me up, Holden said, holding out one arm.
Elvi climbed to her feet and pulled on it, and he somehow managed to stand without falling over.
My heart is racing. It's not supposed to do that.
You're full of fatigue toxins and amphetamines. I'm not surprised you're having hallucinations.
My hallucinations are of the alien mind control variety, Holden said, and took a few unsteady steps toward the next room.
Can you hear what you're saying?
Elvi asked, coming with him and keeping one hand under his elbow.
You're really starting to worry me.
Holden turned, straightened up, and took one long breath. Then he removed Elvi's hand from his arm and said in as steady a voice as he could manage,
I need to go somewhere and turn off the defense network so our friends don't fall out of space and die. I need you to go back to work on the site problem. Thank you for your help.
Elvi looked unconvinced, but Holden waited her out and she eventually headed off toward the area of the tower given over to lab work. In the next room, Amos and Wei were sitting next to a low plastic table, eating ration bars and drinking distilled water out of an old whiskey bottle.
Got a minute? Holden asked him, and when Amos nodded, he added, Alone?
Wei said nothing but hopped to her feet and left the room, hands in the air in front of her to keep from running into a wall.
What's the word, Cap? Amos asked.
He took another bite of the protein bar and grimaced. It smelled like oil and paper.
We got Naomi back, Holden said in a whisper, not sure how far away Wei might have gone. She's on the Rossi.
Yeah, I heard, Amos said with a grin. Chandra was telling me.
Chandra?
Wei,
Amos said. She's working for the wrong people, but she's all right.
Okay. Murtry's pissed about the rescue.
Yeah, but fuck him.
I also, Holden continued, may have shoved him down and stolen his hand terminal.
Stop making me fall in love with you, Cap, when we both know it can't go anywhere.
The point, Holden said, is that he might try to take it out on people here. I need you looking after everyone, especially Lucia and Elvie. They've been the two most helpful to us, so he may try to punish us through them.
Not so afraid of the blind guy, Amos said, even when I'm one too.
That's about to end. Elvie says the drugs are working. People will be getting their sight back in hours or days.
Cap, is this a problem you'd like me to solve?
Amos asked, cocking thumb and forefinger like a gun.
Because that can just happen.
No, no escalations. I already did enough damage knocking Murtry around. I'll pay for that when the time comes, but you only do what you have to in order to protect these people when I'm gone.
Okay, Amos said. You got it.
And what do you mean when you're gone? Holden sat down on the plastic table with a thump and rubbed at eyes that were as dry as steel bearings. The planet was one big ball of humidity, yet he somehow managed to have dry, itchy eyes.
I have to go with Miller.
He says there's a thing that might turn off the alien artifacts, which will get the Rossi flying again and pretty much solve all of our problems. Amos frowned. Holden could see the big mechanic's face twitching as he formulated questions and then abandoned them without speaking. Finally, he just said,
Okay, I'll keep an eye out here.
Be here when I get back, big man, Holden said, and clapped Amos on the shoulder.
Last man standing,
Amos replied with another grin.
It's in my job description.
It took Holden a few minutes to find the storage room with the oddly shaped pillar in the middle, but when he did, the only person in it was Miller. The detective frowned out a "what took you so long" look, and Holden flipped him off. Miller turned away and walked toward the pillar, disappearing into it like a ghost walking through a wall. A few seconds later, the pillar split down the middle without a sound, and opened up into a steep ramp, heading down into darkness.
Was this always here? Holden asked.
Because if it was, and you'd told us about it, it might have saved a few lives when the storm came.
If you'd been where I could talk to you, I might have, Miller said with a belter shrug of the hands. You did pretty well without me. Now get down the ramp. We're late as it is.
The ramp dropped nearly 50 meters into the ground and ended at a metallic wall. Miller touched it, and the wall, in spite of having no visible seams or joints, irised open.
All aboard, Miller said. This is our ride.
Holden crouched to enter through the small round opening and found himself in a metallic cube 2 meters to a side. He sat on the floor, then slid down the wall until he was lying on his back.
This is a part of the old material transfer system, Miller was saying.
But Holden was already asleep. Interlude. The Investigator. It reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out. 113 times a second it reaches out, and the investigator reaches with it, follows, watches. It reaches for a signal it will never find. It is not frustrated, it is not angry. It reaches out because it reaches out. What it finds, it uses to reach out, and so finds more and reaches farther. It will never be far enough. It is unaware of this fact. The investigator knows, and knows that it knows. An awareness in an unaware context. Consciousness within an unconscious system. So, nothing particularly new there. The investigator sighs, wishes it had a beer, knows that these are artifacts of the template.
Once there was a seed crystal that had a name. It had loved and despaired. It had fought and failed and won at great sacrifice. None of that mattered. It had looked for things that were missing, for people that were missing. Everything about it is drawn along by that fact. Something is supposed to be here, and isn't. And instead, there is a dead place, a place where nothing is, where everything pulls back. The investigator reaches out, and what reaches out dies. The investigator ceases to reach out. It waits. It considers. Something was here once. Something built all this and left its meal half-eaten on the table. The designers and engineers that spanned a thousand worlds had lived here and died here and left behind the everyday wonders like bones in the desert. The investigator knows this. The world is a crime scene. And the one thing that stands out, the one thing that doesn't belong, is the place that nothing goes. It's an artifact in a world of artifacts, but it doesn't fit. What would they put in a place they couldn't reach? Is it a prison, a treasure chest, a question that isn't supposed to be asked? A bullet, a bomb still ticking under the kitchen table after the blitz was over. Did he who made the lamb make thee? Or was there someone else? Whoever killed you fuckers left something behind. Something made for your death. And it's right there. 113 times a second it reaches out, unaware of the investigator, unaware of the scars and artifacts, the echoes of the dead, the consciousness bound within it. It reaches out because it reaches out. It knows that people are dying in some more physical place, but it is not aware that it knows. It knows that it is constructed from the death of thousands, but it is not aware that it knows. The investigator knows, and is aware that it knows. The investigator reaches out, but not at random. It looks for a path, and doesn't find one. It looks for a path, and doesn't find one. It looks for a path, and finds one. Not there, not quite, but close. Two points define a line. One point is alive, and one point is death. Neither came from here. Bang those rocks together and see what sparks. See what burns. The investigator is the tool for finding what is missing, and so it exists. All the rest is artifact. The craving for beer, the hat, the memory and the humor, and the weird half-fondness, half-contempt for something named James Holden. The love for a woman who is dead. The longing for a home that will never be. Extraneous. Meaningless. The investigator reaches out, finds Holden. It smiles. There was a man once, and his name was Miller. And he found things, but he doesn't anymore. He saved people if he could. He avenged them if he couldn't. He sacrificed when he had to. He found things that were missing. He knew who'd done it, and he did the obvious things because they were obvious. The investigator had grown through his bones, repopulated his eyes with new and unfamiliar life, taken his shape. It found the murder weapon. It knew what happened, at least in broad strokes. The fine work was for the prosecutors anyway, assuming it went to trial. But it wouldn't. There were other things the tool was good for. The investigator knew how to kill when it needed to. More than that, it knew how to die. Chapter 45. Havelock. Havelock still wasn't convinced that Naomi Nagata was the best engineer in the system, but after watching her work, he had to concede there probably wasn't a better one. If some of the people on the Israel had more degrees or specialties in which they outpaced her, Naomi could make it up in sheer, bloody-minded wildness.
"Okay, we can't wait any longer," she said to the muscle-bound, bald man on the screen. "If he shows back up, tell him where we stand up here."
"Pretty sure the captain trusts your judgment," Amos said. "But yeah, I'll tell him. Anything else I should pass on?" "Tell him he's got about a billion messages from Fred and Avasarala."
Alex's voice came across the comm and also through the hatchway to the cockpit.
"They're talking about building a mass driver, sending us relief supplies."
"Yeah?" Amos said. "How long is that going to take?"
"About 7 months," Naomi said. "But at the outside, we'll only have been dead for 3 of them."
Amos grinned.
"Well, you kids don't have too much fun without me."
"No danger," Naomi said and broke the connection.
"Are you sure this is a good idea?" Havelock asked.
"Nope," Naomi replied.
She pulled herself closer to the command console.
"How's it going out there, Baja?"
The comm channel clicked and the belter's voice hissed into the operations deck. The sound reverberated without giving any sense of spaciousness. A whisper in a coffin.
"We're getting close out here. This is a lot of ugly."
"Good thing we've got a great welder," she said. "Keep me in the loop."
The screens on the ops deck showed the operation in all its stages, what they'd managed so far, what they still hoped, and the countdown timer that marked the hours that remained before the Barbapicola started to scrape against Illis's exosphere and changed from a fast-moving complex of ceramic and metal into a firework. Not days, hours. The tether itself looked like 2 webs connected by a single, hair-thin strand. All along the belly of the Rocinante, a dozen ceramic and steel foot supports made for a broad base, the black lines meeting at a hard ceramic juncture a few 100 meters out. The Barbapicola underneath them almost had all of the answering structures in place. Once the belter had the foot supports installed there too, it would be time for the Martian corvette to use its battery power to tug the belter ship into a more stable orbit, along with its cargo of lithium ore. The complexity of the situation made Havelock a little lightheaded. As he watched, the display showing the surface of the Barbapicola stuttered, and one of the red-flagged foot supports changed to green.
"Okay," Naomi said over the open channel. "We're reading solid on that one. Let's move on."
"Yeah, give me one more minute here,"
Baja's compressed voice said.
"There's a seam here I don't like. I'm just going to..."
The words trailed off. The readout stuttered red and then green again.
"Okay, that's got it. Moving on."
"Be careful," Alex broke in. "Keep the torch cold when you're moving. These lions have got great tensile strength, but they're crap for heat resistance."
"Done this before," Baja said.
"Partner?"
Alex said.
"I don't think anyone's done this before."
The tether lines were standard filament design, built for retrieving dropped Martian marines. Using them to haul a full-sized spaceship was like using a thread to pull a bowling ball. Possible, with enough patience and skill, and easy as hell to get wrong. Naomi had spent 3 long hours strapped into her crash couch before she decided it was plausible, and even then, Havelock half thought she'd talked herself into believing it because she knew that nothing else was. Havelock had spent the time having his connections to Mertry's terminal refused and reflecting on the fact that he'd just spectacularly quit his job. It was odd it weighed on him as much as it did. He was 18 months from home, and probably days at the most from death, and his mind kept turning back to the uneasy surprise with himself that came from walking out on a contract. He'd never done that before. And since he'd gone with Naomi, he wasn't even sure what his legal status was. Somewhere, he'd guessed, between former employee and accomplice to criminal conspiracy. It was a wider range than he knew what to do with. If he was really the face of what was happening on New Terra back home, they were all going to be at least as confused as he was.
The truth was that none of the standards of corporate law or governmental authority seemed to apply out here. He could follow the feeds, read the letters, even exchange recorded video with RCE's home office, but those were only words and pictures. The models based on experience in human space, even the attenuated civilization of the Belt, failed here. Mostly what he felt, though, was relief. He was very aware how inappropriate it was, given the context, but he couldn't deny it. It didn't leave him regretting his choices, except maybe to have taken the job. All the tragedy and pain of Illis would have been merely sad and distressing to see from a bar on Ceres Station. From where he was, the fear had stopped being an emotion and turned into an environment. The last foot support indicator went green. "Okay," Naomi said. "That's looking good from here. What's it like out there, Baja?"
"Ugly as shit, but solid."
"How's your air?"
"I'm all right," the Belter said. "Thought I'd stay here in case anything breaks that I'd be able to fix."
"No," Naomi said. "If this fails, those lines will snap fast enough to cut you in half. Come back to the barn." Baja's percussive snort was more eloquent than words, but the small yellow dot began to move from the surface of the Barbapicola up through the vacuum toward the Rocinante. Havelock watched, his fingers laced tightly together. "Alex," Naomi said, "can you check the release?"
"It's good,"
Alex said, his voice coming from the cockpit and the radio link both.
"We start going pear-shaped, we can let go."
"All right," Naomi said, and then softly to herself, "All right."
"If this doesn't work,"
Alex said through the deck hatch between ops and the cockpit,
"our man Baja is going to watch his baby girl burn to death. I sort of promised him that wouldn't happen."
"I know," Naomi said. Havelock had hoped she'd say, "She won't." It took Baja 18 minutes to get back to the Rossi, and another 5 to negotiate the airlock. Naomi spent most of that time on the radio to the captain and engineer of the Barbapicola. Half the conversation was in Belter Patois, Gerald Sabissa, and Rixik Anenobu. That might as well have been in code for all he could follow it. Havelock requested a connection to Mertry's hand terminal and was refused again. He wondered whether he should write some sort of press release or letter of resignation to the company.
"All right," Baja said, sloping up into the ops deck. His face still had the thin, watery layer of sweat adhering to it. "I'm here."
The readout counting down to the Barbapicola's atmospheric impact was down under an hour. It was hard for Havelock to remember that the stillness of the deck was an illusion. The velocities and forces involved in anything at orbital altitudes were enough to kill a human with just the rounding error. At their speeds, the friction from air too thin to breathe would set them on fire. "Strap in," Naomi said, nodding to the crash couches. Then to the radio.
"Rocinante by here. Dank Sie Ihnen, Jinbiga. Ready konson immer, Sasa."
Naomi smiled. "Counting down," she said. 10, 9, 8. At 4, the displays on the consoles began to shift color, mapping the two ships, the tether lines, the engines, in psychedelic false color. Baja was muttering under his breath, and it sounded like a prayer. Naomi reached 1. The Rocinante moaned. The sound was deep as a gong, but it didn't fade like one. Instead, the overtones seemed to grow, one layering over another. On the displays, the tethers shimmered, the internal forces racing along the spiderweb lines in crimson and orange and silver. "Come on, baby," Naomi said, petting the console before her. "You can do this. You can do it."
"Getting pretty close to tolerance up here," Alex said.
"I see it. Keep it gentle and steady."
The Rocinante shrieked, a high, scraping scream like metal being ripped apart. Havelock grabbed the sides of his crash couch, squeezing until his hands ached. Alex? Naomi said.
Just passing through a resonance window. Nothing to worry about.
I'm trusting you here, Naomi said.
Always can, Alex said.
And Havelock could hear the grin he couldn't see.
I'm the pilot.
Baja gasped. Havelock turned, but it took a few seconds to see what the belter was reacting to. The countdown timer, the death timer, had changed. The Barbapicola was slated to burn in 3 hours and 15 minutes. 4 hours and 43 minutes. 6 hours and 6 minutes. It was working. As Havelock watched, the lifespan of everyone on the ship below him ballooned out. Havelock felt like shouting. It was working. It had no right at all to have worked. And it was working. The alarm klaxon cut through the other noise. Naomi snapped back to her console.
What am I looking at, Exo?
Alex said. The sound of the grin was gone.
Why am I seeing a bogey?
Checking it out, Naomi shouted, not bothering with the radio. Havelock turned his own console to the sensor arrays. The new dot was approaching from the horizon, speeding above them in its own arc above cloud-choked Illus.
Where's the Israel?
Havelock shouted.
Occluded, Naomi said.
We should be passing each other in an hour, is that?
That's the shuttle.
The death timer showed 17 hours and 10 minutes.
The shuttle you turned into a fucking torpedo?
Baja asked. His voice was surprisingly calm.
Yeah, Havelock said. But the payload was the reactor overload, and there aren't any reactors working, so it's running on battery then. That's still going to be a hell of a lot of kinetic energy,
Naomi said.
Is it going to hit us?
Havelock asked, and felt stupid as soon as the words were out of his mouth. Of course it was going to hit them.
Alex, Naomi said, give me options here. PDCs are online, Exo, Alex said. All I've got to do is put a little battery power to them, set them to automatic, and Point Defense can slag that thing before it comes close.
20 hours and 18 minutes. Power to the PDCs, Naomi said. Watch the tethers.
Sorry, Alex said. Just trying to do a few too many things at once here. Powering up the PDCs.
That won't work, Havelock thought. We're forgetting something. The red dot drew closer. The Israel itself hauled up over the edge of the horizon, visual contact still blocked by the curve of the atmosphere. The shuttle sped toward them. The firing of the point defense cannons was hardly more than a brief vibration in the overwhelming strain of dragging up the Barbapicola. If he hadn't known to expect it, he'd have missed it entirely. The red dot blinked out, and then back in.
Oh, Alex said. Huh.
Alex, Naomi shouted, what's going on? Why aren't we shooting it?
Oh, we shot the hell out of it, Alex said. Busted that shit right on up. But this right now is when I'd normally be dodging out the debris path? That's not really an option.
I don't understand, Havelock said. And then he did. The shuttle had been a great big hunk of metal when the point defense cannons hit it. Now it was almost certainly a great number of relatively small pieces of metal, with pretty close to the same mass, moving at very nearly the same speed. They just traded being hit with a shuttle-sized slug for being hit with a shuttle's mass of shrapnel. Naomi pressed her hand to her lips.
How long before?
The ship shuddered. For a second, Havelock thought it was the PDCs kicking in again. Something was hissing, and his crash couch had a sharp edge that he didn't remember. The death clock had gone black. A growing mass of blood around his elbow was the first concrete sign he had that he'd been hurt. But as soon as he saw it, the pain detonated.
Ops is hold, Naomi shouted into the radio. Cockpit sealed, Alex said. I'm good.
I'm hurt, Havelock said, trying to move his bleeding arm. The muscles still functioned. Whatever had hit him, shuttle debris or shrapnel from the crash couch, it hadn't crippled the limb. The crimson globe inching its way along his arm was getting fairly impressive, though. Someone was tugging at him. Baja, the belter.
Get off the couch, the belter said. We've got to get off the deck.
Yes, Havelock said. Of course. Naomi was moving through the compartment, bits of anti-spalling foam swirling in the thinning air like snowflakes.
Are you getting anything over those holes?
Alex asked, his voice disconcertingly calm.
I'm counting 10 down here, Naomi said, as Havelock hauled himself out of the crash couch and kicked off toward the hatch leading deeper into the ship. I didn't bring that many beer coasters. I'm taking the civilians down to the airlock, putting them in suits. Havelock's hit.
Dead?
Not dead, Havelock said.
Naomi finished keying in the override, and the deck hatch opened with a little puff of incoming air. Havelock's ears popped as he pulled himself down into the airlock deck.
How's the tether? Baja asked, following close behind. No damage to the main line, Alex said. We lost one of the foot supports, but I can try to adjust.
Do it, Naomi said, and grabbed Havelock by the shoulder.
The emergency aid station by the airlock door had a roll of elastic bandage and a small wound vacuum. Naomi pulled his arm out straight and pressed that vacuum's clear plastic nozzle into the center of the globe of blood.
What am I looking at, Alex?
Checking, Exo. All right, we've got a slow leak in the machine shop. The port side's pretty messed up. Sensor arrays and PDCs on that side. Maneuvering thrusters aren't responding. They may not even be there. There's a lot of power conduits right around there, too, but with the reactor offline, I don't know if they're hit or not.
The gouge in Havelock's arm was as long as his thumb, in a sharp V shape. Where the flesh had peeled back, his skin looked fish-belly white. The margin of the wound was nearly black with pooling blood. Naomi put absorbent bandage on it and started wrapping it down with a wide elastic band. She had tiny dots of his blood in her hair.
How are we for moving? She asked.
I can go any place you want, so long as it's counterclockwise, Alex said. If there were a dock anywhere within a year of here and we had a reactor, I'd have a vote where to go next.
We'll work on Plan B. How's the barb?
Baja almost had his welding rig back on. Naomi patted Havelock's wounded arm. A small physical statement. You're good to go. She turned to the lockers and started pulling out an environment suit of her own.
She's still coming up, Alex said, but I'm starting to get worried about that missing foot support.
All right, Naomi said. Back the thrust down for now. We'll see if we can get it stuck back on.
Havelock pulled the thick leggings on, shrugged into the suit. He checked the seals automatically. Long years of living in vacuum making it all as quick and automatic as reflex. The suit's medical array kicked on and immediately injected him with a cocktail of anti-shock medicines. His heart raced and his face flushed.
Well, the good news is they're out of shuttles, Baja said. They won't be doing that again.
What are they going to do? Naomi said. It took Havelock a long moment to realize she was talking to him. These were his people, Marwick and Murtry, the militia of engineers. The RCE team had launched the shuttle at the Rosinante and tried to break up a civilian rescue operation. It was a strangely dislocating thought. He'd spent a countable fraction of his life protecting these people, keeping the shipboard politics that always rose up on a long voyage to a minimum, protecting them from outside threats and internal ones. They tried to kill not only him, but the crew of the Rosinante and the Barbapicola too. And the worst of it was that he wasn't actually surprised.
XO, I think we got a hole in the port torpedo rails too. Might want to see if everything's still in place down there. Failsafes are pretty good, but we'll want to check them all if we ever plan to fire one. It'd be a real pity for our own ordnance to blow us up.
Roger that, Naomi said. I'm on my way. Baja, can you coordinate with Alex and get that foot support back where it's supposed to be?
Sure can, the Belter said. The one who'd been part of that first conspiracy to have the RCE people killed. Who had Governor Trying's blood on his hands. For a moment, their eyes met through the double windows of their helmets. Baja's eyes were hard, and then Havelock thought there was something else. A flicker of shame, maybe. Havelock watched as he cycled the airlock open, and then he watched it close. Havelock, Naomi said, I need you to answer the question.
Which question?
What are they going to do next?
He shook his head. His arm throbbed. There was no point to the attack, except spite, and the kind of violence that passed for meaning in the face of despair. If Murtry was behind it, all he'd care was that the Barbapicola went down before the Israel. If it was the engineering militia, they'd done it to show that they hadn't lost. The reasons behind it didn't matter.
I don't know, Havelock said, then sighed. But it will probably be bad for everyone.
Chapter 46. Elvie. Elvie thought her eyesight's return was like coming out of a fog. The green that had enveloped the world was just as vivid at first. It lasted long enough that she was afraid she'd been wrong, or that the long-term use of the oncocytals had made some other change to Holden's physiology that short-term use wasn't having. And then the shadows had lines around them again, little zones of definition. And then, within hours, she could see the doorway arch and the shape of the chemistry deck. By the time she'd been able to see clearly enough that she could tell Holden for certain that they'd solved the problem, the man had been in what looked like a sleep deprivation psychosis. It made her feel a little guilty that she hadn't figured it out earlier. But he'd gone off to talk to Amos, and she was fairly sure that the big man would be able to take care of his captain. And Elvie had too many other things to do. The chemistry deck slowed water purification turned out to be a bigger issue than she'd expected. The distillation filters were exhausted. Material that had gone in as white, puffy pads of spun glass embedded with ionic scrubbers came out slick and green. But the other people from the science team and the survivors of first landing were all starting to get function back too. It took almost 4 hours. But Elvie and Faez and two of the mining technicians had rigged a still just outside the ruins that was converting the fallen rainwater to something potable at nearly 3 gallons an hour. It tasted like fake spearmint flavoring and alfalfa, but it would sustain life. When Elvie found Lucia, the doctor looked as bad as Holden had sounded. Her skin had an ashy tone. And the whites of her eyes were so pink, Elvie was surprised they weren't bleeding. Jacek was following his mother around, carrying her medical scanner and a little sack of bandages. Elvie watched them check on the patients. Everyone was covered in mud and grit. The differences between RCE and squatters were buried under the layers of filth and the shared joy in their returning sight. When Jacek caught her gaze, she smiled. He hesitated, then nodded almost shyly and smiled back. "Clouds are starting to thin," Lucia said. "I saw a patch that was actually white."
"Really?"
Elvie asked. "Still looked greenish to me, of course, but it was actually white," the doctor said. When she shook her head, it seemed to take her a fraction of a second to start.
"You did good work. I've only got 3 people the treatment's not working on."
"Why isn't it working for them? Maybe we should..."
"This isn't science," Lucia said. "It's medicine. A success rate this high on a new treatment for a novel illness? We're doing brilliantly. None of us are back to baseline yet, though. If it happens at all, it will take time."
"Time," Elvie said. "Strange to think we've got any of that."
We've traded up from dying in the storm to dying from the slugs to dying of hunger in a few weeks.
We're pushing the crisis point back. If it's not winning, at least it's a way not to lose. If we can keep pushing it back. But we can't. The words hadn't been said, but they didn't need to be. With the ships fighting each other and falling out of orbit, and the native ecology basically inedible, extending the group's horizon past a few weeks of starvation was going to be difficult, maybe impossible. The stress was showing in the people, RCE and First Landers both. Elvie saw it, the segregation into tribes again, now that the immediate danger had passed. She wondered whether it would come back when the food ran out.
You need rest, Elvie said, and a hand touched her shoulder. Wei and Murtry were behind her.
Wei's expression was bleak. Murtry, on the other hand, was smiling his customary smile. Of all of them, the coating of mud on his skin and in his hair looked almost natural, like he was in his native element.
Dr. Okoye, Murtry said, I was hoping we could have a private word.
Of course, Elvie said.
Lucia nodded curtly and turned away. Elvie felt a little pang of disappointment. After all the trials of the storm and the blindness, the political divisions between the RCE and First Landing were still there, just below the surface. Murtry was still the man who'd burned a building full of terrorists. Lucia was still the wife of a man who'd conspired to destroy the heavy shuttle. It seemed like it should have mattered less now, like the rains should have washed something clean, anything.
I was wondering what you could tell me about the last conversation you had with Captain Holden, Murtry said.
His voice sounded perfectly calm and reasonable. It was like they were back on the Israel, and he was asking her to think back to the last time she'd used some tool she couldn't find.
Well, he was very, very tired, exhausted. It seemed to be having some real cognitive effects.
Cognitive effects like what, please? Murtry asked.
He was babbling, Elvie said, bounding from jokes about mind-controlling aliens to Charles Dickens to insisting that he had some way to shut down the defense network. He was really all over the place. I tried to get him to rest, but...
Do I understand you that he intended to disable the alien technology presently functioning on this planet?
Yes. I mean, why wouldn't he?
Doesn't belong to him. Did he say how he intended to accomplish this?
He didn't. But I don't think there really was anything. It was just his brainstem attached to his vocal cords. I'm pretty sure he was only half aware that he was talking at all.
Did he mention going north?
Elvie blinked, scowled, shook her head. Murtry pulled up his hand terminal, tapped it three times, and held it out to her. A rough map of Illis's only continent showed on the screen with two dots. One, she knew, was the location of First Landing, or where the place had been, anyway. She assumed it indicated where they were. A second dot was almost an inch and a half away.
I took the liberty of tracking the captain's hand terminal signal, Murtry said. Signal's patchy and intermittent, but it seems he's been traveling north at an average of 200 clicks an hour. I find that very interesting.
Elvie handed the terminal back to him. He didn't say anything about it, just that he had something to do. He talked to Amos afterward. I thought that was probably what he meant. Honestly, I'm surprised he can even drive a cart.
He isn't driving a cart, Murtry said. We've only got two carts. They're both right outside, and one of them doesn't even have a power cell.
I don't understand, Elvie said. Then how is he?
Going 200 kilometers an hour, Murtry said. That would be one of many, many questions I'd like to have answered. Thank you for your time, Doctor.
Murtry nodded, turned, and walked toward the archway that led outside. Elvie watched him go, scowling. Had Holden said anything else? She couldn't think of anything. But maybe he'd said something to Amos.
She found the big man standing in the mud outside the work tent where the carts were parked, arms folded across his bare, mud-streaked chest. He had a nasty scar across his belly, and a tattoo of a woman over his heart.